que pasó, tratalo bien. No sé lo que faltó. Am I doing enough for my people? Am I doing enough? Am I doing enough para la gente?
Para la gente.
Para mi gente.
Para la gente.
Para mi gente.
Para la gente.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
Broadcasting from
occupied
territory.
Hello again. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and this is another podcast of Radio Free Aslan brought to you by the Chicano Development Center. Today is August 13th, 2010, and we are here at UAW Local 602 celebrating the 80th birthday of Dolores Huerta and the earlier announcement today of an agreement between two community organizations to petition the city of Lansing to change East Grand River on the north side of Lansing, Michigan, to Cesar Chavez Avenue, along with a city parking lot that is currently known as Lot 56, which is the heart of the Old Town community, where many of the festivals that are held in the Lansing area take place. And that lot will be renamed Cesar Chavez Plaza. So today, we're going to be talking to a whole bunch of different people. Right now, I have with me Diego and Rudy Reyes. I'm going to let Rudy go ahead and say a few words. Rudy is one of the main members of the Cesar Chavez committee here in Lansing that was responsible for the street name change today. So, Rudy, how you doing?
Great.
Good. Tell us a little bit about what's happened these last couple of weeks.
The last couple of weeks have been kind of hectic, I'd say, because people have been talking to each other. People been kind of like, okay, what are we going to do? What's going to happen? What happens if it doesn't happen? Then people from the outside are saying, you know, do this, do that. They shouldn't have this. They shouldn't have that. And people are saying, well, you know, let other people decide for it or have another forum. So there's a lot of input, output, and we still came to an agreement.
So, Rudy, now we've been working on this. We've been working on this committee here for the last several months. Like you were saying, the last couple of weeks have been very hectic. I know that you were a part of what happened in the 90s with the street name change then. I mean, how do you see the differences in the things that have happened?
Well, some of the things are still the same. You still have to go ask a group to see if they'll grant you something. And the city claims to be a world-class city, but you have to acknowledge all the people, other ethnic groups in your city to be a world-class city. So, you know, some things haven't changed, but the people who are working on this thing are some of the same people, but they're more determined, more flexible, and they want to succeed. It's not like we're trying to take something. We're just saying, you know, acknowledge that we exist in your city.
Okay. We're going to take a little bit of a break because I think that the broadcast that is supposed to be coming live from Los Angeles for the birthday celebration for Dolores Huerta's 80th birthday celebration is about to start. And so we'll be back in a little bit, although for you and the listening audience, it will only seem like a matter of seconds. Okay, we're back. They're next door experiencing some technical difficulties, and I have with me Nora Salas and Jose Moreno, who are both History Chicano Studies PhD candidates at Michigan State University. And we're going to talk a little bit about the historical nature of what's happening today. Lifelong resident of Michigan.
That's true.
You were somewhat involved, although you were at the University of Michigan at the time when this when this happened. I mean, tell us a little bit about the significance of, Cesar Chavez Avenue here in Lansing. You know, where do you see this? Where do you see this struggle emanating from, and where do you see it going to in the future? I mean, what does it mean to have this street now?
Well, I mean, I think it'll be a very significant moment when the street signs actually go up. I think that it's kind of a measure of how traumatic the original having the street signs go up and having the honor be there and then having it removed, that I'm not sure that I can fully experience the victory until I actually see the street signs go up. That's how, to me, actually traumatic it was to see them be up and then be removed.
Okay.
You know, the old street, you know, I never drive down that street without thinking about that that experience. And, you know, I still remember the year after. I'm not sure. I think it was on Dia de los Muertos. You know, the year after they had been removed, we marched down that street and we put up some banners with the street aside on and tried to you know, remember the memory of the victory we had had originally with the Chavez Street, and you know, having that removed, it's kind of like a wound in a way, you know, a one and another one in a long line of historical wounds we could talk about. And if it actually, you know, I it's hard for me to really believe it's actually going to happen in a way. So I'll be really happy to actually drive down the street and see it on that day. You know, and I think that it is, you know, there's been some people even then and now who probably talk about how, you know, it's just a sign, you know, what's the best way to honor Chavez. But really, you know, what we're talking about here, when we're talking about what the names and how we're going to identify our space around us here in Lansing, we're talking about the United States of America and what the place is going to be of raza, of Chicanos, of Latinos in the U.S. And that is a very critical conversation that was ongoing when the United Farm Workers was first founded. And it is certainly a critical conversation today.
Sure. Okay, Jose Moreno, right out of Oxnard. I mean, you grew up in one of the battlegrounds for the United Farm Workers. I mean, how do you see the Chavez Huerta legacy? I mean, as it connects from here all the way back home to where you're from.
Well, to be honest, you know, it's okay to honor, you know, both of them, Chavez and Huerta, for their contributions, but there's other people that need to be recognized that lost their jobs, lost their lives for the UW, and to make it a reality, you know, the contracts that were negotiated in the Oxnard area and also, you know, in other parts of California and then also parts of the U.S. We have a lot of people that need to be recognized for their contributions, and I can go on and say names, but I think we need to make that first of all, you know, that thank them for, you know, their contributions, you know, to the UW and to their, you know, to advocate for farm worker rights. But, you know, Chavez, you know, I mean, has a whole struggle legacy in my city because he lived there for a few years. And he organized, you know, in 58 with the CSO. And a lot of people, you know, I mean, uphold him, you know, in that area. And also Huerta has a lot of respect in my community that I grew up in. But I think that, you know, 80 years is a lot of years, you know, I mean, the living. You know, I mean, basically where Dolores went, her attacks, people have attacked her, you know, the beating she incurred, you know, almost, you know, 20-something years ago in San Francisco. She barely survived that, you know. She's, you know, still a fighter. And I think that, you know, after 80 years, you know, I think, you know, hopefully, you know, maybe she'll live more. But what is her future? You know, what is her legacy? That's the question. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, we have to look at that and, you know, to examine, you know, what's going to go happen with. I think also, too, she's a role model for women. There's a long line of women that have fought, you know, in the fields. And I think she's a consideration of that. I think that both of them, you know, I mean, they need to be recognized, you know, for their efforts. However, we need to, you know, go in and do more for the other people that give up their lives.
Sure.
You know, for the farm workers.
You know, I think it's really interesting. You know, Jose brings up this this idea of legacies. And I mean, even for myself in the research that I'm doing, I mean, I recently came across a book, is a book of speeches and letters and newspaper articles that were written by Cesar Chavez. It's called A Organizer's Tale. And it's just a recently published book. I mean, it came out within like the last couple of years. And I find it really fascinating that we have, as a community in some ways, built up this idea of who Cesar Chavez is. And yet the reality is that I think many of us are very unfamiliar with his words, you know. I know that I certainly was, and in reading the book and looking at it and how I can use it for the work that I'm doing, I mean, I was struck many times by his very simple but forceful expression, particularly when it comes to organizing and his and the way that he looked at organizing. I mean, you could tell that he had spent many years doing just that, organizing poor people in poor communities. So, I mean, but when we think about that, what is Cesar Chavez's legacy in the United States? I mean, how, or not even in the United States, what is Cesar Chavez's legacy in the Chicano community?
I mean, I think one of the main sort of qualities that has been communicated about Chavez's struggle and about the farm workers' struggle, and Jose is absolutely right, there was a lot of people who sacrificed. People who sacrificed time, people who sacrificed funds, people who sacrificed their life, You know, there's martyrs for the UFW and for other struggles, similar struggles. There were many sacrifices made, not just by Cesar Chavez, but also by Dolores Huerta and other people. But part of the, and maybe a lot of Chavez's words, you know, the exact nature of his philosophy hasn't been communicated to the Chicano community completely. But one thing that has been communicated and I think resonates still today is Chavez's and his identity and the UFW struggle brought with it a sense of moral justice, of you know, a sense of being morally empowered to act in order to seek a better life. You know, there was never any doubt or any question in their minds that they were on the right side of their struggle. And I think that that sort of conviction is something that stays with the most successful and the most productive of organizers in the Chicano community today. You know, and we have to remember and situate their struggle historically. You know, one of the interesting things is we think a lot about the Chicano movement time period when we think about the UFW, when we think about Chavez and Huerta. Of course, you know, and say, let's say the height of the 60s, how young people often think of it, or the grand community often thinks of it, let's say 1968. Well, in 68, Chavez was 43. Huerta was already, you know, they'd been organizing since the 50s. And, you know, I think that we have this idea that, you know, there was a lot of young people involved, but it was really a broad cross-section of the community. I was really going somewhere, and I can't remember where I was going.
I mean, it seemed to me like you were headed in the direction that they weren't kids, and that, you know, they've been doing this for a while, and that, you know, it was very, that the in situating the farm worker movement historically, right, that what you're really looking at is a very disciplined movement.
And I think that, you know, it definitely it was, but I think also they built the sense throughout the 60s until you get to the late 1960s and the early 1970s, where they really embrace, you know, the sense that there's not anything wrong with trying to seek a better place, a better place in society for farm workers, and is, you know, inextricably linked to a better place for people of Mexican descent.
Yeah.
And they get to this place in the late 60s, early 70s, where, you know, they abandon this idea, you know, that the way to achieve in society is to assimilate and become Mexican American. You know, that whole strategy that so predominated earlier time periods. And that's part of their moral force, is that they're no longer, to me, you know, when you go through their writings, when you look at the film, when you hear the interviews, it's not just the sense of the farm worker struggle, but the sense of themselves as raza, that they have embraced that and that they move forward with the full confidence of that. And I think that is very empowering in the sense of, you know, look at the time period, late 60s, early 70s, you know, it was something very surprising when, in some ways, when people first came out, you know, brown is beautiful. That was it's overused, but in some ways it was a revolutionary idea. And they came out with all that force, and certainly, you know, my personal association, we're here today on Dolores Huerta's birthday, you know, she embodies that. You know, I don't think that she certainly embodies the idea that you can do more when you have the courage of your convictions.
Sure. So, Jose, I mean, in your own work as a community organizer, and I mean, you've been doing this work for many, many years, in addition to the academic work and the scholarly work that you do, I mean, how do you see this sort of ideological leap forward that Nora's talking about? I mean, where is that today in the community, and how do we work today to you know, make the same type of transition that Chicanos made in the late 60s and the early 70s?
Well, you know, I think the major issue is that we have more of us now here. The demographics has changed, and we have a mixture of different generations of Mexicans and Latinos coming from, you know, recently arriving here, and then second, third generation, fourth and fifth. And I think that we have to do is combat generational gaps and come together and to work on broad issues. I think that's one of the problems that we have, you know, in organizing the communities. And then with, you know, farm workers, it's a little different because a lot of them are migrant workers and they just come and go. And they don't stay there in the community as a connection. And then a lot of them are undocumented, you know, now. Because the farm workers in the 60s, 70s, a lot of them were, you know, residents and legal residents and citizens. But it changed in the 80s, the demographics changed. People coming over, so it became more, you know, migrant workers. Came, you know, and either they don't settle or they do settle, or they move to different jobs, you know, services and different. So a lot of people move into different areas. But it's just, you know, it's, I see it, you know, because, for example, a Mexican-American will call a person Mahalo, you know, or the person from that cross, you know, came over here will call a person, you know, me, Porcho. So there's those, you know, those cultural differences that, you know, part of the colonial mind that still exists here. But the problem is that we have to deal with that. And then you have, you know, especially the immigrant rights movement, you have different splits. You have people that believe in reform. You have people that believe in, you know, just get, you know, amnesty or just, you know, policy, get rid of policies in general, open borders, you know. And it's so broad. I think you see it, you know, I mean, you see the differences in basically immigrant rights, but it's not all about immigrant rights. It's other issues. And I think, you know, when Chavez organized, it was grassroots. And the Huerta, when they first started union, they used the CSO perspective and Zelensky perspective, going out to the doors, knocking. And I think that was successful in the union early days. But after that, you know, when they had to unionize and go mainstream, unionized perspectives, that changed. And I think that was one of the things that hurt them, because they lost the community support, because that's why the union kind of declined in the 80s and 90s and the present, because they had a community base, because they built bases in the community. They use that, you know, approach, and I think that's the difference of now and then, you know, and yesterday when they first started out.
Okay, all right, all right, very interesting. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales. This is a continuing broadcast of Radio Free Aslan. We are tonight at UAW Local 602 celebrating Dolores Huerta's 80th birthday and the recent announcement of Cesar E. Chavez Avenue in Lansing, Michigan, which would replace the street that was taken away from the community almost 15 years ago. So we'll be back in a little bit. Thanks. Okay, we're back, and we're still at UAW Local 602. Now I have with me two old Lansing homeboys, St. Paul Benavides and Paulo Gordillo, both members of the recent Chavez committee that was able to bring the street back here to Lansing, Michigan. Paulo is the individual. He's the guy that did this the first time in the 1990s. It was at that point, it was pretty much a solo effort. He started going door to door, put pressure on the city council, and the city council agreed with him. They thought it was a good idea. We're going to talk a little bit about what happened after that. And then my man Sane here has been around doing his thing for long time now, right, Sane?
Yeah.
So let's start with Sane, because he's looking a little unsure about this. Sane, why don't you tell us why you got involved in this effort this time around?
In all honesty, I think back to 94, and I can only wonder, where the heck was I? What was I doing? What was I thinking? I grew up with Derek Gordillo, Paulo's older brother. Part of the same, I was never part of their neighborhood because I lived a few blocks from them, but I was always in their neighborhood with the different friends and whatever up and down the street. There was a bunch of us down the street, Mexicanos. But watching what Paulo did, and I watched it from a distance, I can't begin to explain why. I got involved when we lost the street, and I still didn't quite understand the impact and what it really meant to the community, to a couple generations right there. I mean, Paulo really expanded it. Here's this young kid that talked loudly, talked proudly, wasn't afraid to get the heck out of my way if you're not with me. You know, willing to shake hands and willing to knock on anybody's door. And I still didn't quite understand what was happening. Back then, I was in my late 20s, and just working with youth programs, and I really should have been involved. When this came around and the opportunity came up, Al Salas came up to me, and he approached me, and he asked me if I'd like to be involved and to be with several of you. And I have to say it. It was an honor and for me a learning experience to be at the same table with Paolo, yourself, Todd. Me and you have we took different paths, I think, along the way, but by the same token, I've always admired the way that you ran into things head first. Sometimes with success, sometimes with not, but you always you always had that passion, and
always had a headache at the end.
you never were afraid, and I'll tell you, anybody who has that passion, I always admire. So to sit with people like yourselves, it truly was something special to me. So I mean, I had that chance, I took it. I wanted to sit at the same table. I wanted to be part of history, and I knew we weren't going to lose this time. There was just no way. Too much experience at the table. I mean, I think you guys learned what was going to work and what wasn't. And I tell you, in the very end, I mean, it was your guys' leadership that that pushed us through. Definitely.
Well, I mean, it was all of us working together. I appreciate what you're saying, brother. But it was really all of us working together. It was. But it got kind of froggy there at the end, didn't it?
It sure did.
It got a little different. Yeah.
Real interesting.
Paolo, why don't you tell us a little bit about your effort back in 94? I know sometimes you get a little tired of talking about it, but it's important, man, because it's a big part of who we are as Raza here in Lansing and in Michigan and in the Midwest. So, you know, let's know a little bit about what happened then and, you know, how you saw this situation develop and why you got involved in this last effort here, this successful effort.
All right. Well, this really started back in like the 93-ish era, 93, early 94. And to be perfectly honest with you, it just kind of woke up one day and said, you know, we need, you know, something in this town that will recognize the Latino Chicano community here. And at that time, just recently, Logan Street here in Lansing was renamed to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. I kind of looked around and said, you know, where's something that we have? Where's something that we can have that's tangible, that we can kind of call and claim that's ours, that's our own? And so I kind of looked around and said, we need to do something. Figured out kind of a little bit of the system from the standing of how a lot of the African American community kind of organized and went about renaming their street, and said, all right. So I went down to city council, asked them what's the procedure. They didn't have a procedure at the time. They now do. But went down and said, hey, you know, I want to rename a street. How do I go about it? They all looked at me like I was cross-eyed and weird and was like, what? You want to do what? And at the time, I was like 19, 20 years old and said, you know, this is what I'm going to do. So they said, well, why don't you start with maybe getting some petitions or getting some signatures? So went ahead around my neighborhood, started going around the Lansing community, got together about 600 or so signatures. At that point in time, I really didn't know what I was going to do with the actual signatures. So went to the city council one night, which, you know, who goes to the city council? Right. So, but I'm there. I'm like the youngest cat in the whole room. People are in there talking about the neighborhood stuff, and I get up and say, listen, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. I have a bunch of signatures, and I want to give them to you. And people were just looking at me like I was totally crazy. They were like, signatures for a street? What? You want to do? Hold on a second. But at this point in time, the press got involved, and they started figuring out, you know, what I was doing. And I said, well, listen, this isn't about me. This is about Lansing. This is about like the community here in town. You know, we look around. We want something tangible. We want something we can call our own. You know, and this street is something that we can't. Renaming a street after Cesar Chavez, you know, a great labor leader, a great American hero, a veteran, someone that we can say, you know, this is a leader. This is someone who represents our community. And so the ball got rolling there. Went to the council. They said they'd sit on it for a while. They passed it to a few committees. You know, a couple of months literally went by, and I stuck with it. The community started rallying. We started having marches. We started getting together. I started raising a little bit of money, trying to figure out how to pay for things. And this kind of went on from there. At this point in time, right around the time of the vote, the city council got involved, and they were really behind it. It was a 7-1 or 7-0. Everybody voted in favor of it, and the street got renamed. There was some opposition at the time, not very much. The main opposition was from some of the businessmen on the street. It was called Grand Avenue. and just a few, one person in particular, Fred Stackable, who was the primary person who was in opposition to this. And he was a lawyer, had a lot of money, and it was, you know, it was a little interesting. So we got the street approved, we got our street signs put up, we held a huge celebration. Richard Chavez, Caesar's older brother, we flew him in from California. He came and spent some time with us, he marched with us. We had, you know, huge rally in Lansing, big march, lots of people, literally several thousand people showed up. And we marched up and down our street, and we had all the street signs covered up. We unveiled them to the community. It was a really big to-do. It was a really big deal. We were one of literally just a handful of cities at the time in the entire nation that had a street named after Cesar Chavez. So it was a really big thing. So for the better part of a year, the street signs were up. But all the while, in the background, what was going on was Fred Stackable was organizing. And what he was doing was getting people together, collecting funds and resources as well to run a campaign against the street and have it voted off. So a little later that year, he gathered enough signatures, and he also put it in front of the council. But he actually, what he did was he held a special election. This is kind of what, you know, really puts Lansing on the map. For one, it's the only city ever to reclaim a street named after Cesar Chavez, which is a huge black eye for the city. And that's, you know, nothing against the city or its leaders, but it's the only city literally in the nation to ever do this. So he organized, he got enough signatures, and we held a big a vote, a special election. And a special election in June is unheard of. There are always the primaries in November and the regular elections, but in June? And so there literally were, give or take, 13, almost 14,000 people. And at the time, Lansing isn't a huge city and was even smaller then. And 13,000 people coming out to vote is a big deal. And unfortunately, they voted it down. Again, not a great thing for the city, not something that they can, you know, hang their hat on by any stretch of the imagination. They want to be called a world-class city, not the great place to start. So at that point in time, the fight kind of ended. The community was mad. Folks were rallying, you know, to kind of take a step back when Stackwell was organizing, and it was in the media that he was trying to take the street away. A lot of folks came out, which was phenomenal. A lot of folks came out and showed their support, and, you know, and that was great to have a lot of people. But at the same time, we unfortunately lost the vote, and that is, you know, not a great thing, but I think it made a lot of us stronger. And with regard to Todd's original question, what made me get involved with the current campaign, it was, and I'll be honest with you, it took some doing for folks to convince me to kind of get back in this. Not because I didn't want to, not because I didn't want to, you know, honor the legacy of Cesar Chavez, none of that. I just remember the fight, and the fight was a long, hard fight. And for the initial part of this, I was alone, and not to say that in a bad way against anyone or anybody in particular. It was a hard fight. I received death threats. I had to move out of my parents' home. Folks said, you know, we're going to bomb the house. I had my mailbox literally blown up. Someone poured sugar in my gas tank. Folks would send me messages, and back in the day, it wasn't email, or there was, but not really. And I'd get literally handwritten letters, which I still have, saying, you know, get out, go back to your own country. We don't want you and your Mexican people here. I mean, just crazy stuff. And it was hard, I'm not going to lie. So, and not in fear of doing it again or going through that, I just remember the fight and had asked myself, you know, is this something I want to get back into? And I'm a little older now, and, you know, somewhere in my mid-30s. And I was, you know, I was young then. I was 19 or so back in the days. And then I think, you know, I was resilient. I was basically fearless. And now I'm a little older, and I have kids, and I have a wife, I have a career. And it was a little different. So when I got word that they were doing it again, which is a phenomenal thing, and they approached me and said, hey, would you be in support of it? Well, of course I will. And then they asked, hey, would you be a part of the committee? And I had to sit on it for a while. I really had to sit and think and say, well, you know, is this something I want to do? I talked to my wife and said, you know, she remembers the fight from back in the days. And, you know, I even talked to my kids and said, you know, for my kids who didn't know the things that I'd done in the past, you know, this is what I did, this is what I used to do, you know, by getting back involved with this, just letting you know, it might get a little hairy. Thank God it didn't. It's a great thing. It was very professionally handled, and that's a great thing, and that's a nod to the OTCA and their group and how it was, you know, really handled in a well manner. But it took me a little while to kind of think about what I wanted to do, and whether or not I really wanted to get back in this, but in my heart of hearts, you know, of course I want to honor Caesar. It's been a literally for me a half a lifetime goal to do this. This is something I've been doing more than half of my life. For over 20 years I've been trying to put something like this together. And you know, like Todd mentioned, this is something that I may have started, but I never lay claim to this by any stretch. Yes, I may have started it, but the community has always finished it. And I've never wanted to do anything that goes against the community, that goes against the, you know, the wishes of what they want. But this is something that we truly need. I mean, Lansing needs to know that the Latino Chicano community is here. It's vibrant. It's a big community. And we have to understand that, you know, we need something that's tangible, something we can call our own, something that we can say is ours. And it also, at the same time, recognizes the Latino Chicano community here in town and recognizes, you know, who we are and what we are. So, and I know Todd at the moment has left for just a minute, but hey, Saint, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
With regards to Todd's original question, I know you were involved, so not as much in the original campaign, but what brought you to this committee?
What brought me where?
To the committee, to kind of this new endeavor.
I wanted to learn what, being honest, I really wanted to learn what you guys went through, because I missed it. I mean, I missed it completely the first time. I didn't go to anything until after the street was taken away, and I watched. It was fascinating, because I mean, I watched people cry. I watched people very angry.
Yeah, I cried.
you know, and you know, and I was in my late 20s. I mean, you know, you're talking 94. I was going on 30 years old, and I didn't, I gotta be honest, I didn't quite understand the impact that Chavez made on the community, on the, in the country. I didn't quite understand who this man was, Cesar E. Chavez, and for him to impact Lansing. So I started asking questions and finding out he was here. He was here often. He made quite a few friends. He loved coming to Michigan. I was able to pick up different books, and back then there were very few, so you'd have to actually find them. But
yeah,
I was able to
search
for
him. Yeah.
Yeah, I was able to connect with Michigan State, and they were able to track down a couple, you know, mainly used ones basically. It's funny too, because I think of brand new books of with Chavez, and some of them are hardly read, and it only goes to show you that the generation that we have today, the younger generation, knows nothing about this man. They're not willing to take the time to read about this man. I read a book 2 years ago. I don't recall the title, but it was hardly, you could tell it was hardly used, and I guess that leads to my answer, is that we can't forget who this guy is. I mean, not only did he impact people across the country, whether they knew it or not, I mean, he impacted our families. I mean, my parents were migrant workers down south. They moved to Michigan to get out of the fields, the same very fields that this guy stayed in to fight for the, you know, the many people who couldn't fight for themselves. I mean, they didn't know how. I mean, I wanted to know, I guess, where my parents were. I think the only time I was ever in the fields, they have a picture of me sitting on top of a truck when I was 2 years old. That was it. I never had to work in the fields, and I thank God for my parents, because they made sure that I didn't. I work for the government these days. I have a decent job, but I wanted to know what they went through, and I wanted to know what the people back in the early 90s went through. I mean, to the memories I have of especially people being angry, and you know, I always remember this, Q106, and I shut it off. Q106 did the, win your own, very own Mexican, the little promotion they ran, and I was amazed. I thought, what the heck is that doing on the radio? It was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard of. I was offended, I was mad, I was angry. I shut it off. That was all I did. It wasn't until I realized what was really happening in Lansing, I thought, let me get involved, and I started coming around a little bit. By then, it was too late, you know, for me to do anything, and I always regretted that. I always did. So for this time, it was a no-brainer. Al Salas was kind enough to ask me to step aboard, and I can't say I regret it at all, one bit. I've learned a lot from the many people, but I wanted to see where my parents had been. I wanted to see from that group, that community, what they went through. I mean, it's part of us. I mean, no matter how we look at it. If he didn't even know who the man was, I mean, he impacted our families.
Oh yeah.
One way or another. Oh my gosh, this guy. I mean, he is part of our family, no matter how we look at it.
Yeah. Very true.
I'm back. Sorry, we were having some technical difficulties with the feed, and I was talking to my people over in LA, and we couldn't get it worked out. So I'm not really sure what's going on with that.
And that's where it stands. Couldn't get it worked out.
Yeah, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So, all right, you guys got anything else you want to say?
From my standpoint, for me personally, it's I'm just glad it's over. Sort of. I mean, this truly isn't completely over yet, but it's close, and that's something that that's a good thing for Lansing, for the group, for the community as a whole. And I think, you know, Shane mentioned how he had a hard time finding books on Caesar years ago, and now, you know, they're everywhere. And that's something that I think we can attribute to the works of a lot of different people in town, like Todd and a lot of other folks who have really been, you know, leaders in the community and have really been fighting for, you know, the rights of the farm workers, and going back to the Great Boycott as well. And, you know, Shane mentioned the Q106 issue, and all those things really impacted the city of Lansing, and I call it the kind of the trifecta of craziness. But those things, you know, being said, I think, you know, the old saying, you know, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. So all of us, you know, being in this fight, whether it was years ago or you know, the current struggle, we're coming away with a lot of knowledge. We're coming away with a lot of information. We're learning every day, and we can take this to another issue down the road. So for me, I think it's a great thing. It's a great day. We're celebrating, you know, our street and the Sister Chavez Plaza. So I think, you know, all in all, it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing too. This is Todd Morales with St. Paul Benavides and Paula Gordillo rocking out to the sounds of Chispas Calientes in the other room, UAW Local 602. We'll be back in a second.
All right.
Okay. So on this auspicious evening, we have with us two elected officials here to help celebrate Dolores Huerta's 80th birthday and the recent victory, compromise, agreement, whatever word you want to use, which brings Cesar Chavez Avenue back to Lansing, Michigan. We have Nino Rodriguez, Dr. Nino Rodriguez, and we have Mr. Guillermo Lopez. Gentlemen, thank you for sitting down here and talking with me for a minute.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dad. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you and the company you have with you here tonight.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rodriguez. I appreciate that. Guillermo looks skeptical.
No, I'll just say ditto.
What we're going to do is we're gonna actually start with Guillermo right now, because a little known part of this whole story about Cesar Chavez Avenue actually has to do with a radio station here in town, Q106. And Guillermo was one of the community leaders at the time who really took a stand against the racism that the radio station was exhibiting towards the Latino community. And, you know, I want him to talk a little bit about that and how that intersects with Cesar Chavez Avenue.
Well, you know, that certainly was a bad time in Lansing, Michigan, you know, for Latinos, and frankly for the community, because it did stir a lot of sentiments, you know, in the community. But the particular episode was Q106 was airing a parody, which was Rafaelina Mexican, and his return to win a Mexican, you know, and basically saying that whoever won the Mexican, they would bring him from Mexico in the wheel well in the inside the wheel well of a truck or something like that. And the other part was that, but it was a responsibility to delouse them and disinfect them and do all things. So that was really bad, you know. And really my cuñada from Adrian alerted me to that. And I remember when I first heard it, my daughter, Victoria, was there with me. And she said, "Dad, why are they saying those things?" Now, keep in mind, my daughter was in elementary school at that time. So it's been quite a while. So that and brought the community together in a negative way, brought the community together to a positive way. Okay. And you were part of it, Todd, as well. And so when we got together, I think we did a lot of things that were not expected of us.
And that showed that when it comes to push and shove, we can get together.
Yeah.
And we do.
Yeah.
And we do.
No, it was an important moment, I think, for all of us really to really stare into the face of just unapologetic, you know, dislike. I mean, Tim Barron was very clear that, and over the months after that, when, you know, yourself and other people really began to pressure him through official channels in the FCC, and I mean, he really began to lash out, and finally, you know, teaming up with Fred Stackable, who was a lawyer at the time, whose office was on Grand Avenue, who was opposed to renaming that street to Cesar Chavez Avenue, and just the on-air campaign that they waged against not only the street itself, but against the entire community. I mean, it's incredible, you know. So we have Dr. Rodriguez here, and Dr. Rodriguez is a lifelong educator. He's retired from the Lansing School District. He's now serves on the Lansing School Board along with Guillermo. And Dr. Rodriguez, I mean, you're not originally from here, but you've been here long enough that nobody really knows that. And so what I'm wondering, Dr. Rodriguez, is this. I mean, how do you see this? I mean, you grew up in Spain. I mean, you grew up under Franco. You know, you came here. I mean, you've seen fascism, you know. I mean, what's happening here in this country right now, Dr. Rodriguez?
Okay, thank you very much for this great question. I suffer under Franco. Yeah. One of the reasons I am here is because I didn't want to go back to serve in the army,
yeah,
in the military army in the Spain. And that was the reason that I decided, after teaching Aquinas College, and I was only 29 years old, and I left the religious organization that I belonged to, then I decided to stay here and don't go to the army to serve him. And anybody who was not in the Franco side was guilty of something. Mm-hmm. And today in our country, to be Mexican or to be Latino means you are guilty of something.
Right.
And you go out and you see the people and you feel that something is going wrong with your raza. That something is humiliated and you don't supposed to tell anybody who you are. That is very unfortunate. When I see the Mexican-American, the Chicanos, what they did to this country in the last 500 years, but most in the last, and especially in Michigan, in the last 100 years, they built this society because they were hard, because they are intelligent, because they dedicate their time to their families, because they raise education, and because pride and service is in their blood, then humiliation is the last thing you can do to a people. You cannot humiliate them or me or anybody anymore when they are people who create this country the way it is today.
Right, right. That's true. That's beautiful. I mean, it's Guillermo, did you have something you want to follow up with that?
Oh, can I follow up on that?
Go ahead. I know, right? I'm not even sure what to say.
See, he passed it on to me.
Well,
wow. It's true. And then what happens is that these folks, because they cannot demean us in a humane way, you know, they react to fear mongering and that kind of stuff that really is a bad time in our country. And I say it's my country because I am a naturalized citizen. I was not born here. I was raised in Texas, you know, from the age of 4, and I went through the Chicano movement and so on and so forth. But it was in Michigan that I became a citizen. And so I see what was happening back there, and it seems like we're going back to those times. You know, where we were not respected, you know, we're blamed, and it's so because I think it's more of their fear than whatever we ever do, and they fear the fact that, like Dr. Rodriguez said, you know, we've been contributing to this country's well-being for a long time. Every time, you know, there's a need, who's here? The Mexicanos, you know,
yeah.
Latinos now. Because now we have more Latinos here than Mexicanos, pero the basics is that Latinos are always here when the United States needs help.
Right.
Look at the wars. I mean, who came and provided the labor? You know, who has been there to fill the gap when it's needed? It hasn't been Latinos.
Yeah, yeah. So now, I mean, almost 15 years later, I mean, we have you know, the return of Cesar Chavez Avenue. I mean, this has been a heavy psychological burden on our community for over a decade now. You know, what does it mean for the future here in Lansing that we have been able to work with a group of people to rename the street, that it's a community-wide effort, and that you know, this is, you know, that we've been able to recapture this monument?
Two ways, at least. The first way is for us, Chicano, Latino, and this community. It's a happy day, the day that we are going to have Cesar Chavez be honoring here in Lansing. It's a happy day for us. We march together for Grand Avenue to be Cesar Chavez. We were hard at the time, and 15 years later, the spirit of Cesar Chavez moved us, and especially the committee, to do what they are doing today and what we are going to have in the future. That is for us. We should be very happy, very proud. And even I don't belong to the committee, I always said from the beginning, we don't need to belong to every single committee of the Latino Chicanos, but we need to support each other in what we do.
Sure.
And the supportive move is what we are now. And the second is for the rest of the community. One for all, Cesar Chavez is a great human being for the whole humanity. And they had to accept that. Not only accept that, but take it in their culture and their lives and promote what Cesar Chavez is all about. And Guillermo can talk about services in the community. But he's a hero, he's a man, he's a person. They can be a model for everybody, and is a model for everybody. But in order to be a model, you have to admit what he did and what he said and what he was all about. And that is not a restrictive value. It's a universal values that he practiced and he taught us.
Right. I like that. I like that. That is not a restrictive value. That's very true. There is nothing restrictive about admitting the value of what he did, because he worked for all people. That's absolutely true. Guillermo?
Well, you know, the other thing we need to keep in mind, though, is that this is a victory and a great day for Lansing Latinos in the committee, but we cannot stay there. You know, it seems that we always do that. We get a victory, we celebrate it, and then we forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, and then we go back into our daily lives or back to sleep, if you want to use that. And I don't want to be negative at all.
Right.
I'm not. I'm just saying that we should take advantage of this occasion to talk about what's important in within Latino community. Not only that we need to be involved, that we need to vote, and that people know that we vote. We need to do that. We need to build on that. We need to continue to ask for meaningful immigration reform. That's very important. And we just need to continue the fight in terms of ways that we can be successful. And Dr. Rodriguez said the right thing. You know, not everybody has to be in one committee. You know, I think it's harder to be a follower and supporter than trying to be the leader, okay? And I think we need to learn that. We need to learn that, and by and large, you know, that does happen a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it brings you back to the Q106 issue, you know? There were a lot of people who were supporting. And it was a victory for us that even though the guy was not off the air, but he certainly had a hard time staying, you know? And so that was good. And now this victory, we need to kind of retool and ensure that this pushes us to continue to work and not to go back and feel comfortable again. You know, I think that's one of the pitfalls that we have. Yeah, we need to learn how to get out of that.
Right.
And how to continue.
Right.
And conversations like this hopefully will help. And I think that that now that we've done this, now what else are we going to do? What is the next step, you know, in the development of the community?
Yeah, so, that's a good. Those are good questions. Those are good questions. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales. This is a broadcast of Radio Free Aslan, brought to you by the Chicano Development Center. I'm here with Dr. Nino Rodriguez and Mr. Guillermo Lopez. Both of them are elected officials to the Lansing School Board. Gentlemen, I really appreciate you sitting down here and talking with me. I want to salute you both for the years that you've spent working in the community and particularly on the school board. I know that that is a thankless job. Go ahead, Dr. Rodriguez.
You and your group is a revolutionary group for many, many years. Usually the people who are the revolutionary, and we celebrate 100 years of the revolution of Mexico this year, usually are not the beneficiaries of their work and their sacrifices. It's us, the people aside, outside, and the generation after you, they are going to receive the benefits for your work and your hard work and the other people like you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and I hope that one day this radio can be here from all over the state, all over the nation, all over the world, and celebrate the virtues and values that you and your group sacrificed so many hours and so many, many moments of courage to do what you are doing.
Well, thanks, Dr. Gregory. It's from all of us. And that's Chispas Calientes kicking it live in the background, and we're going to be back in a second.
Thank you.
Hello again, everybody. This is Ernesto Todd Morales, and we're back here at UAW Local 602 with the Chispas Calientes kicking the cumbias live in the background. And I have with me now two real union organizers, Mr. Pete Vargas and Mr. Tim Russ. Pete is currently with Service Employees International Union, organizing
security officers.
Security officers, and Tim is late of the Teamsters. He worked for United Parcel Service. Is that correct, Tim?
Correct.
And you were part of a nationwide organizing drive back in 19.
From about 97 to 2002, I worked with a national network of UPS workers.
And then you worked at Labor Notes.
No, I worked with. This is when I was working for Teamsters for a Democratic Union.
Well, there you go. So what we have is the labor movement. It's in the house. It's at Radio Free Aslan, broadcasting from behind enemy lines.
Oh, yeah.
Gentlemen, you have both been here long enough to know what's going on with Cesar Chavez Avenue. Why don't you give us your take from the labor perspective? Either one. Jump right in.
Well, I mean, Lansing is a labor town. But it's not always been a labor town that's friendly to the diversity of the community. And so it's important that the labor movement embraces the importance of the diversity of the Lansing community, and that reflects the kinds of labor figures from around the country that embody the importance of diversity in the labor movement. Because just, you know, organizing the bourgeois workers in the high-paying jobs in the plants is not the only thing the labor movement is about. And so it's important that the UAW workers here in the Lansing area, those who still have jobs, understand they're part of a national movement for the betterment of all workers. So,
okay. And so, Pete, nobody will ever accuse security guards of being bourgeois. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you're doing, and, you know, how you see it fitting into the overall scheme of, you know, what's going on tonight?
Well, we know historically over the last few decades that the labor struggle has been very much that, a labor struggle. Republicans have done a great job at weakening labor laws and making it harder for folks to organize and exercise a right to join a bargaining unit. And so we're conquering a couple different things right now. One is the labor movement is constantly changing and evolving. The union that I'm with, Service Employees International Union, is changing with those times. And, you know, we started off organizing folks that nobody else wanted to organize, the folks that nobody cares about, which is, you know, janitors and home care workers, hotel workers and food service workers, all the folks that that are frowned upon as far as occupations and are some of the lowest paid but highly exploited workers in this world, quite honestly. And our next phase of that is organizing some other workers that folks seem to overlook that are being highly exploited right now, and those are security officers across the country. Those are the folks that are on the front lines of protecting the things that we hold dear within our communities, whether they're our schools or whether they're, you know, our grocery stores or political offices or administrative offices. They're, you know, taken advantage of every day, and so we're our next endeavor is to make sure that they're represented within the labor movement, as well as we're going to do our best to higher their standard of living, and I'm happy to be a part of that new growth.
Okay, so I mean, what we see, I mean, we've seen union membership drop dramatically over the past decade here in the United States. We know that SEIU just recently broke with the AFL-CIO, and a number of other unions broke with them, and they began this Change to Win.
Correct.
Change to Win campaign. I mean, what does it mean in a country where workers are routinely exploited to have this sort of like new energy come into the labor movement, into you know, standing up for workers' rights? I mean, what does that mean in terms of how that kind of filters down into the fields, the work that the United Farm Workers and the Farm Labor Organizing Committee and other unions like that are doing around the country?
Well, I'm a member of the largest union. It's called the National Education Association. We're the largest union, but we're not even in any of the quote federations of labor. And you know, one of the things that the one area of the labor movement that has sort of kind of held its own is the public sector. But we see in our politics these days, especially here in Michigan, where you see the erosion of living standards, that every time there's a problem with the budget, no one ever talks about the importance of having a progressive tax system that actually expects people to pay what they can afford in taxes if they're wealthy and they're doing well, and that if they've experienced the prosperity of our country and they become wealthy, we don't expect them to pay a fair amount of taxes. And so we have constantly, our system is being eroded. Our public sector is being absolutely devastated because of these right-wing politicians that continue to blame public employees for all the things that are going wrong in our country, when it's profit that's the problem. It's the exorbitant profits that corporations are making. We have a banking collapse, right? But we still are attacking employees. We're still expecting employees to take pay cuts. We're still expecting employees to take layoffs. And the real solution to the problem is more taxes on the wealthy to afford a vigorous public sector that can provide the social services and the education that our community needs for the future. But at the same time, the private sector workers that are making these huge profits for these companies need to be organized. They need to have an opportunity to be in the union, because that's the only way their standard of living is going to go up. That's the only way standard of livings have ever gone up in the United States. If you look at the decline in the union membership, it directly correlates with the growth in wealth among the top 20% of the income groups in the country. And the direct correlation between decline in union membership and the concentration of wealth is the problem. And, you know, Change to Win and the AFL-CIO, it doesn't really matter what union you're trying to join. If you can't join your union because the employer can hire $1,000 an hour attorneys to come in and threaten you, force you into captive audience meetings to try to keep you from joining a union, it's going to be difficult for you to join a union. That's why in 2008, the number one priority of the labor movement in the 2008 election, it wasn't electing Obama. It was electing a coalition that could pass the Employee Free Choice Act. And we still haven't gotten the Employee Free Choice Act. And now we're already headed back. Many pundits say we're headed back in the other direction. If the Republicans are successful this fall in this Tea Party stuff, we'll never, the energy that has been built over the last few years is once again going to be pushed back, because we don't have, the labor law is not in there to make it possible for us to effectively organize, unless we start going back to the old days when we were outlaws, you know? So
No, absolutely. I think we've definitely seen over the last, 30 to 40 years, a humongous shrinking of the middle class. But you've also seen a change of jobs in the public sector that are available, and we've turned into a service industry, right? Whereas when unions were in their heyday of industrial jobs as well as agricultural jobs, which is where obviously the United Farm Workers were in their heyday at organizing folks within that sector. We found that, whereas, CEOs 30 or 40 years ago were only making about 10 times more than the workers, than their lowest paid worker, now they're about 600 times more than their lowest paid worker. When you got CEOs of our banks right now that are making in excess of $10,000 an hour, whereas, the folks that are actually working in the banks, like the tellers and things of that nature, are only making about $10 an hour. There's a huge disparity there, right? I think that within the labor movement, there's a lot of unions right now that are seeing the writing on the wall, recognizing that they have to evolve, and they have to stick a lot more of their money where their mouth is when it comes to organizing, the working class, and they have to get back in the streets. They have to start kicking rocks again and knocking on doors and realizing that these workers are pissed off enough that they want to change, but they're ready to be asked.
Okay, all right.
But, the other part of it is, that organizing has to happen not just from the labor movement cannot be the only force in the community that's organizing. Organizations like the Chicano Development Center that are educating people about what it means to be organized in the community and drawing links between the conditions in the community and the conditions at work, so that people are open to the idea of joining unions, that's even more important to some extent, because the culture of our communities is to some extent become hostile to the idea of being in part of unions, because some people, even those who are most importantly need to organize into the labor movement that are in the service industry jobs, they think that the labor movement is a relic of the old manufacturing economy. We talk about here in Lansing, when we talk about unions, people automatically think we're talking about the UAW. But UAW is not even the largest union in this area anymore.
Right, right.
It's because the auto manufacturing industry is declining and other industries are growing. And so, but that doesn't mean workers need unions any less.
And on top of that, The labor industry in general, as far as like going after some of these companies, 30 or 40 years ago, we were not the international multinational conglomerates that we are today. So the playing field has changed quite a bit when it comes to the corporate profile, and it's not just here in the United States where we're feeling that crunch, right? I mean, we're in a world market of workers right now. And I just had a conversation this morning with Swedish transport workers in Sweden that whereas historically 70% of their workers are organized, okay? But because they've also been, they've fallen to the same MO that all these other multinational conglomerations are in fighting back against worker power, all of a sudden they're having to organize again, and they haven't had to organize in decades. And they said, Pete, we don't know how to organize our workers because we've always taken being involved in labor for granted, because it was normal to them, which is something very different. When we only represent, about 11% of all workers right now in the United States are organized. Only 11% in the entire country are part of unions right now.
Wow, that's really low.
Yes. And 30, 40 years
ago. That's including the public sector.
Correct.
Which in some state, like in some industries in the public sector, like the whole northern tier of the country where public employees have bargaining rights, public employees are wall-to-wall union. So places like Michigan, where there really isn't such a thing as a non-union public sector worker, in places like Michigan, the public sector is going to be a larger and larger portion of the economy because of the decline of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. The union density is not declining in the state because we still have public sector workers and unions, But in places like in the South, where there are no bargaining rights for public employees, those union densities are even lower. So there are many places in the country where if you work for a private company, you have a better chance of being in a union. Like if you live in Texas, I mean, joining a union is a lot easier in the private sector than it is in the public sector. Whereas in Michigan, it's the opposite. Sort of the political climate is hostile to unions in some parts of the country, which means organizing is even more important. And one of the problems is we have a legacy of being powerful in Michigan. And so the difference between organizing and our power, people don't understand the link between the power of the labor movement and its ability to organize in places like Michigan. Whereas in the South, the only power that unions have is the power they get from organizing.
Right.
And that may be limited, but they understand the link between their efforts in organizing, both internally and externally, and their power. And we developed in the North this idea that the union is like an insurance policy and it provides a service. And that's why in Pete's union, they don't even call their union reps, right? They call them internal organizers, because that's what they do. They organize the workers for their own power. And in our union, we call them Uniserv directors, right? Talk about the contrast in terminology.
Right.
But we still do organize. I mean, you have to organize, right? It's just the idea of what is the primary function of a union? Is it organizing or is it service? And it's got to be organizing for us to turn things around. And it's got to be linked with things in the community, too. So,
and we have to bridge the gap. Obviously, like, we're here right now for a couple of reasons. One is we're celebrating Dolores Huerta's 80th birthday and her legacy of what she's brought, not just to the labor movement, but also to the women's rights struggle, okay? We're celebrating her legacy, but it's also the onus is on us to package in a way that the generation today, the Gen Xers and the Gen Ys, can say, I am a benefactor of her struggle, and I have a responsibility to continue that, because the livelihood and quality of life that I have right now is a direct reflection of the blood, sweat, and tears that folks like Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez did, right? So how do we do that? Okay, most of us have, come from families where either a father or a mother were part of a union at one point in their life. Okay, we're getting a little bit farther and farther away because we're actually having kids at a younger age. So we're actually going to be a generation away from ever being connected to being in a family, a union family, right? So how do we bring it back? You know, and that's my everyday challenge. And people laugh when I say it. But I said, we need to bring sexy back to labor, okay? We need to make sure that in the same way that all these young folks are gravitating in their rebellion against the Republican Party and Democrats by joining the Tea Party, we need to make labor the clearinghouse for young folks that are saying, you know what, I want a more democratic way of living, okay? There's nothing more democratic and revolutionary than having a say in your workplace and having control over the 8 hours that you give or the 12 hours that you give every single day of your life, okay? And saying, you know what? I'm worth more than you're giving me. I deserve for the contribution that I make to your pockets and to your Mercedes-Benz, the opportunity and the access to healthcare, okay? What is more revolutionary than changing your quality of life for your direct family? And we need to package that in a way that folks say, you know what? I'm deserving of that also, you know? And so, I mean, that's something that, like, if I could really, really just, you know, emanate that out, you know, across the world right now, is that we need to step up. We need to take, you know, the lessons that Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez have given us, own it, and make it in process that information and share that knowledge that they have to our children and to ourselves. And that's something that every single person in the United States has a right to do. Who wouldn't want to be able to have a say in the workplace, right?
Right.
And when the law says by the National Labor Relations Act that you have a right to have a say, who wouldn't want that? Yeah. So we need to get that word out And we need to bring sexy back to labor.
Okay, so on that note, my name is Ernesto Todd Morales. This is Radio Free Aslan from the Chicano Development Center, and I want to thank Pete Vargas and
bring
Tim Russ.
Sexy back.
Bringing sexy back. What's up, baby? We're going to come back with the last interview of the night. This is Ernesto Todd Morales. We're back with the last interview of the evening. I have with me Elva Reyes and Lorenzo Lopez, both members of the Lansing for Cesar E. Chavez Committee. Elva is our fearless leader for this last endeavor. And I want to thank both of them for taking a couple minutes to talk to us at the end of the evening here. Elva, how'd you do it?
Oh, I don't think I did it. I think that was everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. We had a great committee, a group of people very dedicated. And we had our ups and downs, the way committees do. But we all came through it. We all came through it just fine.
Okay. All right. So just remember to lean into the microphone when you guys are talking, okay?
Yep.
All right. So we came through it just fine. Lorenzo, like Elva, you're a lifelong resident of Lansing. I know that you were involved in the very first effort back in the 90s. I mean, how did this one happen differently? And, you know, what do you think it means for the future?
Well, one of the reasons that I think it happened differently is because we have a particular different generation of more sophistication of members of our community who are able to put their biases aside and achieve one particular goal. That was the goal, and everything else was on the side, and I think that made the biggest difference of all.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with that also. So, Elva, what's going on with the Cesar E. Chavez committee now? What's next?
The committee, basically, when we applied for our nonprofit status, we had already started plans for working within the community. Part of that was the educational piece for our children. We feel that there is a tremendous dropout rate amongst the Latino children especially. We're gearing ourselves up for that, hoping to partnership somehow with the Lansing School District to work something out.
Okay. All right. Lorenzo, tell us a little bit more about this whole thing. I know you got more that you want to say.
Well, I just think that it's long overdue in terms of our community, not only here in Lansing, our state, and our country. We have to assume positions of leadership and in every aspect of American life, and that's what we should be doing. We should be mentoring all of our communities to take part and participate and stand up. That's what Chavez did. That's what he would want us to do.
Right. Okay. You guys, that's it. I really appreciate you coming here and talking to me right here at the end. And I think it's time to get back over to Chispas Calientes and shake that groove thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and this has been another broadcast of Radio Free Aslan from the Chicano Development Center. We're here wrapping it up at UAW Local 602. After speaking with many, many community members tonight, it's been a very, open conversation about the status of the Chicano Latino community in Lansing, Michigan, in the Midwest. I think that it also demonstrates the breadth and the depth of experience and knowledge that we have within our own communities. And I think that it's important for us to remember that Lansing is not solo, it's representative of communities all over the country. And so once again, I want to thank everybody for listening. I know this was a long one, but hang in there. Vive la causa.
This podcast is brought to you by the Chicano Development Center, a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to education and political empowerment through grassroots coalition building. We believe in the indigenous sovereignty of the Chicano people in the United States, and that true social and political change begins with the people. Our style of low-intensity organizing endeavors to build intentional communities within greater communities. The motivating force behind low-intensity organizing is to constantly challenge the status quo as to the treatment and economic status not only of Chicanos and other indigenous peoples, but all oppressed peoples. At the Chicano Development Center, we believe resistance begins with education, organization, and preparation. We believe that RASA must take action on a regular basis, not just in times of crisis.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
This is Radio Free Aslan.
Broadcasting from
behind
enemy lines.
I go home? Am I doing enough for my people? Am I doing enough? Yeah, am I doing enough? Para la gente,
para la gente,
para mi gente. As J's, what we love the best.